Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust. Hey everybody, well, 2020 is officially in the books, and I think we can all agree, good riddance to that year. Although, I think emergency medicine did show its true colors in terms of showing what we're made of, the metal we have. We can step up to the plate, we want to step up to the plate, and really, as long as we're safe ourselves, we just want to keep everyone else safe. So, first off, congratulations for surviving the year and really showing everybody what emergency medicine is all about. Couldn't be prouder to be a member of this field of medicine and just medicine in general. It's a good time to be a physician, I think, as long, again, as we're all safe. So I did spend a little time in the December issue with the best of 2020, which is that we did it all. We really did as emergency docs. And so I just want to talk through here some of the most read, most popular articles in ASAP Now for the year 2020. And then we'll also do a little bit of the year in review of the emergency literature from one of our resident experts. Well, he's not a resident, he's an attending, but you know what I mean, Dr. Ryan Radecki. Anyway, let's get right to the best of 2020 in terms of what everyone voted with their clicks. The articles online that really attracted the most attention here. And really, if you think about 2020, you have two major stories. Obviously, you've got the COVID-19 pandemic, SARS-CoV-2 itself. And I think the other big story, if we hadn't had a pandemic this year, it still would have been a major year worth remembering, just in terms of the fact that we also confronted racism and equity in medicine in a really new and important way. And the ongoing discussion about sexism, gender equality really also was a major story this year. So those are the really big ones, I think, that are so important. Let's start with COVID-19. When you think about, if you had to guess what would be one of our most popular articles of the year, maybe you would not be surprised to learn that the initial paper that we published about COVID-19 was called COVID-19 for the Emergency Physicians, What You Need to Know. And Christopher Green and David Piggott wrote this, and we got it out on March 10th. And really, when you think about it, it's just amazing. We were talking at that point about who were PUIs, persons under investigation, who had travel risks, and what should we do in terms of testing. And knowing what we know now, of course, we would expand a lot of the indications for testing, but even the discussion of personal protective equipment for ourselves, I think, was pretty on point there. March 10th, face mask, using a fitted N95, or if you have to use a PAPR, the air purifying respirators, and eye protection, gloves, gowns. We were right there on top of it, and I think it's just a good sign that we can kind of stay with the currents, and also, of course, we updated things as we needed to this year. So obviously, we got things right early, but we had no idea that we'd be in this for so long. I think many of us, I was certainly surprised. I certainly knew we had a big problem on our hands by then, but wow, I think we've all been surprised, or most of us have been surprised, just how bad this has gone. The other thing I think is important is that we also covered some other areas that were really popular with the readers, was looking at the pros and cons of various types of testing. So we looked at why you might use PCR versus antibody testing, and this all seems second nature, but again, at the time, I think this was pretty big. And another biggie, and I will say this over and over again, if you want to write an article that's going to get a lot of reads, definitely write about pediatrics and pregnancy. People always want good information about pediatrics and pregnancy. And certainly with COVID-19, that's been the case. We had an early article about the safety of ibuprofen for kids in COVID-19 because there had been some reports. And again, this is all sort of the problem when you have a developing crisis like COVID-19. There had been reports that maybe there was a possible harm associated with ibuprofen and COVID-19. And so Landon Jones and Richard Cancer wrote for us in May saying, look, we don't think that's really a huge problem. The WHO had gotten out there and said, well, maybe there is a problem. Then they backtracked and said, no, there's not a problem. And so by the time we commented on this, we were saying, look, we don't think that we can say that ibuprofen truly is a problem. And so it's probably fine. And so, yeah, all things equal, do I pull Tylenol? Sure. But I also wouldn't have any problem with ibuprofen. And the current most up-to-date guidelines from the American Academy of Pediatrics also bears this out. So I think we can feel pretty good about that. All right, so as I mentioned, the other major story this year would have been the lead story in any year, really, is really dealing with the question of medicine and how we have dealt with issues of inequity, racism in medicine, also sexism. And when I started my position as medical editor-in-chief, one of the first things I did, I think it was the first thing I did, was to create a recurring column in the magazine called The Equity Equation. And the first curator of that, one of the co-curators of that column, was Dr. Uche Blackstock, who has gone on to actually be such a big force in the field of medicine in general that unfortunately she does not have time to manage this column, but we still keep it going. And Dr. Blackstock wrote a really important article about combating microaggressions in the workplace. And I think that this is a big deal because too often it gets simplified. If someone isn't saying something horrifically out loud, that then people incorrectly assume that there's not really a problem with race inequality or racism in medicine. And this article really proves that, or really for me, proves that that's not the case and that we can do something about that and that we have to look out for those microaggressions. And this is not an attack on everybody. This is not saying we're all bad people because we have to fight this issue. It's just really expanding our viewfinder and to be a little bit more sensitive and aware of some issues. And frankly, I learned by reading this. So I invite you all to check that out. We also had a great piece, another very popular piece in the magazine, lots of clicks, called It's Not a Female Resident Problem. And this is about the issue faced by women in medicine in terms of what they encounter in training. And so sometimes there's difficulty with respect towards female residents in the emergency department. Do they get overlooked when it comes to being seen as the go-to on procedures, that kind of issue? So let's do ourselves a favor and be a part of the solution and not part of the problem. So that really is the two big ticket items, I think, sort of COVID-19, the pandemic in medicine throughout the world, and the equity problems in medicine, another sort of epidemic, if not a pandemic, that we can face that really has a mortality associated with it. If you think about the differences in mortality among different races in the U.S., it's not just genetics, let's be honest. It's not, oh, okay, there's more this disease or that disease in certain populations. That does not explain the difference in mortality that we see. The difference is mostly explained, I think it's a great way of saying, the social determinants of health, that your zip code has a lot more to do with your health than your genetic code. And unfortunately, it's not just where you come from. It's also, we've learned the hard way, what you look like, because people don't get treated the same, and that can be really harmful. So we are working on that as a country, and in a way that we're not pointing fingers. We're not saying you're bad if you have ever not been up to speed on something, and you're good if you have. It's just a matter of how we can all improve together. That's how I look at this. Let's move into another clinical area that I think is always on our minds as emergency doctors, and we certainly have a new pandemic, but we also have an ongoing opioid epidemic, which I think sometimes we do forget about. And we had a really popular article in the magazine about the fact that when you have patients who overdose, they often will be given naloxone, right? This will save their lives. And of course, we do know that naloxone will precipitate withdrawal in some patients, so they're not very happy with us in general. And it turns out that we can manage precipitated withdrawal. And in the past, it's certainly been thought of as something we would manage symptomatically with a bunch of different options. Some people are giving clonidine, which will have some impact. And there are other options as well, which I'm sure are in your armamentarium. Some people will just treat the antiemetic component of it with Zofran or ondansetron. But interestingly enough, this is kind of, in a way, simple, but I hadn't thought of it really very clearly before. But using buprenorphine, which is the active ingredient in Suboxone, long-acting opioid, buprenorphine actually can also be used for precipitated withdrawal. Now, the thing is, though, is that it's kind of like you have to get there with your mind for a second there, because buprenorphine is a partial agonist, just like these other opioids. It's a mu receptor affinity agonist. And so it will bind to those receptors really aggressively. And so what will often happen is people who are given buprenorphine for opioid use disorder will be initiated with these small doses of buprenorphine, like 2-4 milligrams sublingually, after they go into withdrawal. And a lot of patients will report, first of all, that made him sick. Buprenorphine actually made him sick. And that's because they actually were underdosed. So if a patient ever says that they hated buprenorphine, it's likely because they were underdosed at the time when their opioid withdrawal scale was high enough that they needed to be initiated. They would benefit from being initiated on opioid replacement therapies, but they weren't given the right amount. So that's actually a missed opportunity. And so an alternative approach also to dealing with precipitated withdrawal is to use buprenorphine, which again, if you gave a small amount of it, could make the patient feel pretty crummy. But if you give a big whopping dose, and we're talking the idea of a future initiation pathway, which could skip these test doses and go right to a big dose, maybe 16 milligrams sublingually is what's suggested in this article, that actually would be a great way to not precipitate withdrawal, to give long-lasting protection from the cravings and the overdoses that could happen as well. And so this was by Rachel Haraz, Gerard Carroll, Ruben Strayer, and I thought that they really moved the envelope here by saying, hey, it's not as simple as you think. Patients say that they've had precipitated withdrawal and things got worse with buprenorphine. They weren't wrong. So it's really a dosing problem. And so the solution is to really up the ante. So look around your area to see if in the near future the protocol is changing, because I predict that it will, and we'll be doing a better job managing the naloxone mediated precipitated withdrawal, which we of course expect when we're trying to save a patient's life, and sometimes we overshoot. But also just in general, if you're thinking about starting a patient on opioid replacement therapy like buprenorphine, the low dose that a patient may have gotten in the past probably did make them feel really bad. And so the solution to that is to give them actually more, not less, and to tell them, hey, I recognize that this didn't go well for you in the past, let me explain why. And I think when they understand that you understand, they're more willing to give it a go, because it's actually the right treatment for so many patients, and some of them had a bad experience with it, and we don't want to repeat that, and we also don't want to let that go, and it's a missed opportunity. Another huge article that got tons of clicks was Ken Milne's The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, doing a dive yet again on alteplase for acute ischemic stroke. Another reboot of the idea that if you look at the groups in the trials, and they weren't balanced, and so maybe if you rebalanced them and said, hey, wait a minute, comparing the patients who are equally sick to one another, how does this drug do? And the answer is not great. So the search for stroke treatment algorithms does go on. But I think that increasingly the thrombectomy is looking better and better, and alteplase looking worse and worse. We also, of course, saw earlier in the year the New England Journal article in which patients actually went to thrombectomy with or without alteplase given, and there was really no difference. So that's another kind of blow to alteplase. Certainly, ASAP Now is a place where we have covered this issue, and we're going to keep doing it because stroke is such an important disease to treat, and we have an opportunity to be a part of that. The other article on the evidence-based side of things that really got my attention, and apparently yours with the clicks, again, because this is the most clicked popular articles of the year of ASAP Now, was EM Cases, Dr. Anton Hellman's article, IV versus PO, which antibiotics are better for common ED infections. And I think we all kind of know deep down that a lot of the IV antibiotics we give are just as good oral as they are IV. But Dr. Hellman went through some of the indications and evidence behind that. And the one that really just rocked my world, rocked my planet, made me think, oh my gosh, what am I doing? It was not the idea that you could give oral antibiotics for pyelonephritis or for soft tissue infections. I think we all kind of know the indications there. The one that really shook me up a little bit was bacteremia. Okay, like really? Apparently you can transition to PO antibiotics for bacteremia in an evidence-based way in a certain subset of patients. And they actually looked at a study of 5,000 hospitalized patients with Enterobacter bacteremia. And the 30-day mortality was no different between patients who got oral step down after an appropriate clinical response to IV antibiotics. So this might not be for your patient who's undifferentiated bacteremia in the ED. I'm not talking about those. But you think about a patient who might be boarding, or a patient who might be in OBS, the observation unit who you're rounding on, who's been just like, they're waiting for the cultures to go out. We're going to see what goes on here. here. Well, it turns out that we could even get involved with the transition to oral antibiotics, or at least we could advocate it to the teams who are accepting these patients on the floor. So I just love that whenever we can do more with less, because we all know that IV antibiotics, of course, they have all kinds of problems associated with them, and it's more work for our colleagues. The nurses are so busy, and so can't we make life easier? One fewer IV line. If the line blows, you don't have to go there with the ultrasound-guided IV on the patients who are tough sticks. It's a win-win. So loved that article and can see why you all did too. Next up, as promised, let's turn to some more literature from the year 2020, the year that was. And as you might expect, we had some really good stuff from Ryan Rodecki, whose column EM Lit of Note is always popular, good CME and quiz material for us as well. And Ryan's got a lot of great stuff here, covers some stuff on imaging, which I'll skip over, and stroke as well, but check it out. And we, of course, went over the antibiotics for appendicitis yet again, because I think that's an idea that we really wanted to highlight the evidence on. But what I thought in his year in review article really stood out was the top of his article, which is some things about cardiology, which I think are really interesting. So let's start with the high sensitivity troponin, which I think has become pretty widespread. And he covered a study from Europe looking at some algorithms. And of course, the take homes that we want to take out of this, the most important thing is that a single high sensitivity troponin that's below the detection assay, not the normal range, but actually below assay, in the right timing, in the right patient, is sufficient to rule out acute myocardial infarction. That's what these algorithms show in the studies he's covering. But what I think is also really important is this other point that he makes, which is that unfortunately, the assays and algorithms still fail to provide enough clarity to the users, such that nearly a third of the patients evaluated still required, quote, continued evaluations, despite the additional precision offered by the tests. The next subtopic in cardiology covered here is the use of computed tomography coronary angiography, CTCA, to exclude acute coronary syndromes in the initial evaluation of chest pain in the ED. And there may yet be some role here, Ryan's writing, in terms of the diagnosis. And there's a study in which CTCA was used prior to invasive coronary angiography in patients with the NSTEMI, the non-ST segment elevation MI, and they found that nearly a quarter of patients were shown to have coronary stenosis under 50%. The implications being that downstream management could be changed, right? The resource-intensive, costly procedure might be avoided in a bunch of these patients. So I thought that was really interesting. Another thing that we all think about a lot when we're evaluating chest pain, especially sort of the lower risk cohort, the ones who aren't going to the CCU, for example, or the cath lab, is what to do with patients who maybe you're not quite sure about. Should we do non-invasive cardiac testing, stress testing, that kind of thing? And there's a large study coming from Kaiser that is covered here, just really trying to tease out that those who actually might benefit. And what I thought was interesting was that there actually might, there may be a benefit to such testing early on, these sort of non-invasive stress testing early on. But it would really take between 200 and 500 of these tests to find any patient, one patient, who might have one additional good outcome, and that's not necessarily mortality. So I think what this shows is, on one hand, I think there are two kinds of doctors. Maybe there's three, but there's two kinds, I think. People who think that stress tests are super necessary and they save a lot of lives, I think those people are probably wrong, and that in the sense that they're overdone and they save very few lives and help very few people. And then there are people more towards what I feel, which is that stress tests are completely useless. Now, I will say that with a caveat. I, of course, have seen a stress test be positive, and I was glad that I got it. Of course, I don't know whether or not that patient would have really benefited from waiting or whether the cath really helped them downstream, but I certainly have been on the side of, I think, stress tests are over-ordered and the benefit has really never been as great as people might have been taught. So this study really did kind of make me stop and go, well, maybe there is a patient out there, a few patients out there who benefit, and that I shouldn't poo-poo, if you will, the number of patients that we do stress tests on, but maybe we just need to get better at finding out who they are so it doesn't take 200 to 500 tests to find one reasonably change difference. So that's really what to me stood out here, was that maybe there's some hope yet, but we need to do a much better job of refining who we're sending to that strategy. And then last article on the cardiology front was one of these ECG article looking at whether computers are any good at ECG interpretation. And actually what was interesting on this one is they didn't include medical students and trainees. They looked at just physicians with a lot of experience, and a little humbling here, right? With downstream information finding that the physician accuracy was 60 to 80% on ECG interpretation. And it's unclear what that really means, but the take home I took was the computer might be a little better than we thought. But of course, you always want to ignore the computer if it's undercalling something, because you certainly don't want to get in the situation where those peak T waves that the ECG does not pick up are that evolving ST segment elevation MI, for example. So there's lots of examples of this. But just always interesting to see the ECG literature changing. And I suspect as computers get better and better, this number will be even better, that we're going to have to really be at the top of our game to compete with these computers. All right, as usual, we've got much more in the magazine. Love the residency spotlight, got UCSF covered this time around. We've got Medical Legal Mind looking through a tough case in terms of transferring patients. You always want to know what to do with your money and how not to throw it away. So we have End of the Rainbow. We had some really great stuff in terms of an interview with the incoming president of ASAP, Mark Rosenberg, who's now the president of ASAP. And we have images in EM and talks in EM, really great stuff. So I love this. The end of the year really summarizes what we do. So again, thank you for all you do to save lives, to improve care, to bring other readers ideas. I am here to help be a conduit for your ideas. So please send them my way. And looking forward to a better 2021, but no doubt we will still be making the same impact to help our patients and our communities. So I salute you on behalf of everyone out there who I know really does appreciate emergency medicine more and more as every day goes on. So here's to a better 2021, and thank you for your hard work. Bye. ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.